the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studio in New York City. All over the world, we have people watching and listening, and syndicated shows throughout the entire country. People listen for different reasons. And taking into account that we have an enormously diverse audience, from one group, almost 9% of our audience are between the ages of 13 and 18. So we try to find out what are they interested in? How can we give them insights that can empower them? Our largest single group of people listening and watching are between the ages of 35 and 45, college-educated, listening at night. We have people who are from all political backgrounds, all religious backgrounds. And now just imagine sitting down at the beginning of a week and deciding, what are we going to do in 7 different segments per day to bring them insights? And that's what we do. For example, today, a classroom on the air, which means we're going to go more in-depth than normal, and we're going to talk about probiotics, the lactobacillus and bifidus bacteria species that can help us ward off chronic diseases. They feed your intestine, and that is important. We'll deal with that. Also, edible flowers. No one ever talks about edible flowers because most people never eat flowers, but you should. And if you don't eat flowers, how about growing them? I was just at the farmer's market, as I like to go on Saturdays, and see what's new and exciting. And they have these little edible flowers and these little baskets, and they have little sponges, and the sponges hold the water to keep them fresher. But if you actually took the flowers out, which I did, and I weighed them, they weighed about an ounce total. That's very light. But they were about $9. $9 an ounce, 16 ounces to a pound. Well, that's a very profitable business. They're easy to do. So you ought to consider growing edible flowers and selling them at the farmer's market. I'll tell you about edible flowers and how they can inhibit chronic disease. Drinking 3 more or more cups of black tea a day are good. And also something really positive for teenagers suffering from leukemia and what can help them. And essential oils are found to be good against tonsillitis bacteria. And also a lot of people suffer from sudden cardiac death or arrhythmias or abnormal heart rhythms. I'll show you how to deal with that as well. Over 10 million Americans have irregular heartbeats. Then I'm going to talk about double dipping. Doctors paid to advise and promote drug companies' products that then they get money for. That's a conflict of interest. And this is an answer to Rush Limbaugh and many others who believe that the poor are poor because, well, they're just lazy and they don't know how to spend their money. The facts show otherwise. Also today, there's a petition for change. Bill Gates, end your investment in private prisons. Well, most people didn't know that he had invested in private prisons. We'll tell you why that's not a good idea. Merck's former top doctor predicts that Gardasil will become the greatest medical scandal of all times. And from our social issues, and a lot of people appreciate this part of our program, from Chris McAvel from Global Research, School Privatization and the Charter School Scam, Corporate America's Neo-Feudal Assault on Education. Now, I have two thoughts on this, because unlike a lot of people, I wanted to see whether or not it was possible to work with a charter school and see if it could make a difference, not for the students, but for the parents. You'll be surprised by what we discovered. You've been told, get out there and get into the American dream. Buy a house. Houses are up in value. No, they're not. It's a scam. You're being lied to. I'll tell you the latest on how the actual charts of who owns the house they've been foreclosed on and why the market is not up and why you should be careful. The prison industrial complex, it's big business, but is it also a new form of slavery? Vicky Pallez from Global Research. How predatory college loans are bankrupting the financial future of American youth by Sean McCollum. And if time permits, I'm going to give you a quiz. I want to see who can answer it. The U.S. is now spending what percent of all of our available tax revenue just to pay interest? How much do we pay on interest? Who do we pay it to? And why should we pay it at all? My guest in the second part of our program from Carlsbad, California, will be Dr. Bart Billings. He is a retired Army colonel, a former military psychologist, and founder and director of both the Military-Wide Human Assistance Rapid Response Team Program to deal with combat stress. But we're going to talk about psychiatric drugs and the psychiatric failure to treat military personnel. I've interviewed over 1,000 of our former vets, some who've tried suicide, some who've hurt other people, all of whom have had their lives destroyed. None of that occurred before they went into Iraq and Afghanistan. They're all victims today, as we are. Why are we failing to understand how to help these people? As you see, we have a lot to share. Let's begin. I like to use edible flowers. In fact, recently at a retreat, I took pansies and I took three different types of edible flowers, nasturtiums also, and I decorated the plates. And first, nobody would eat them because they thought it was just pretty decorations. But I'd also taken a spray, and what I like to do in my kitchen, I have about 20 different bottles of reductions. For example, I'll take, depending upon the time of year and what's available, I'll take a fruit or an herb. For example, when lemon basil, if you were to close your eyes and just have a little taste of lemon basil oil, you would think it was lemons. But it's not. It's basil. But it's grown with a hybrid of lemons, so you actually taste like lemon. So what I do is I take the basil, maybe a gallon of it, and then I press it, and then I juice it, the rest of it, and I don't get a lot. Might get out of a gallon maybe a teaspoon of oil, juice. Then to that I add distilled water, or just water, into a 1-pint little container that I can spray or spritz on an item. I'll also take tangerines, and I'll do a reduction of tangerines, maybe loquats. So you can do it with just about anything. And even avocado. So the reductions you can then liquefy. So let's say I want to make a salad dressing and someone doesn't want the normal salad dressing. They want something a little more exotic. So I might take some apple cider vinegar and some lemon basil with a little honey, and I spray it all and toss the salad. It's very exotic. I can do the same thing with raspberry and orange. So I take raspberry infusion and an orange infusion, liquefy it, spray it, and toss a salad with raspberry and orange. Now again, you're not going to taste this out of a bottle. It really tastes great. And then toss in to your salad some edible flowers. There's at least 35 different flowers that are not only edible, but power-packed with antioxidants, nutrition, and unique flavors. Very tasty. This is the latest on edible flowers. This is from the Institute of Food Technologists, published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Food Science. Quote, a group of researchers found that edible flowers, common edible flowers, are rich in phenolics and have excellent antioxidant capability. Edible flowers, which have been used in culinary arts such as in China for centuries, are receiving renewed interest. Flowers are now becoming integral parts of recipes, and not just as a garnish. And because of their phenolics, they can turn off inflammation in the body and reduce your risk of cardiovascular disease and even certain cancers. So that's good. So start going to the farmer's market, looking for edible flowers, and then trying them. And you'll love the way they taste. Also, if you've ever looked at a garlic, as a garlic starts to grow, it'll give off a microgreen, and it has a little tiny bulb on it. And that bulb is sweet and rich in garlic flavor. Shallots are the same. And that's frequently the edible part that you can use in salads. Some cultures drink tea. Historically, Americans have not. Here's the latest on why, from 150 to 200 milligrams per cup of flavonoids and antioxidants, it can make an enormous difference in your life. This is from research that was done, published in the journal Nutrition Bulletin. Quote, drinking three or more cups of black tea a day protects against heart disease, and two or more cups a day can protect against type 2 diabetes. And it depends upon the tea and the flavonoid content and the antioxidant ingredients. It can even counteract cardiovascular disease. This was a 12-week study using volunteers. They drank three cups of tea a day, quote, and produced significant improvement in various cardiovascular risk factors. It can control inflammation, reduce excess blood clotting, promote blood vessel function, and limit damage to the arteries. How about that? That's good. Now, of course, a big problem we've had is leukemia. Other cultures do not have the same incidence of leukemia that we do. I believe it. A lot of it can be contributed to from the lifestyle that we have. Two Ontario physicians published in the peer-reviewed journal Case Reports in Oncology a promising treatment resulting in a 14-year-old girl diagnosed with a very aggressive form of cancer, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, with a and she had a chromosome mutation, and they found that what really made a difference was cannabis oil. The oil was enormously beneficial. It's also called hemp oil, and it has promise for helping with massive inflammation, including of cancer. So, quote, the blast cell count reached a peak of 347,000 on the 25th of February, day 5, followed by a decrease which correlated with the increased dose of the oil. The daily dosage is the amount administered per dose. The doses were initially given once per day, up to a total of three times a day by the 15th, and were continued with the same average frequency throughout the treatment. And it required less morphine for pain, It increased the euphoria symptoms. It decreased memory loss and an increased alertness. And that was all from the cannabinoid use, end quote. So, that is important. So for those who have leukemia, cannabis oil or hemp oil. And speaking of oils, the essential oils found antibiotic against tonsillitis bacteria. This is from Francis University of Angers, and it's determined that certain essential oils are effective in killing the bacteria that cause tonsillitis. The researchers, according to Case Adams, a real natural, utilized 18 different essential oils provided by a French group, and cinnamon, lemongrass, oregano, thyme, winter savory, clove, palmarosa lemongrass, camphor, peppermint, marjoram, lavender, which is one of my favorite. By the way, if you're ever living in the country, by all means go out and plant by hand lavender. It'll take a year to come up, but then it's a perennial, and you'll just see the most beautiful. It just looks like something out of a Salvador Dali painting of a landscape. The colors, the brightness, the lushness, just to be able to go out and lay in a field of lavender. That is what I would recommend. Also, you can use lavender. It's got a very good market for it. Tea tree, basil, and rosemary. And what they found from just those oils is that they extracted the bacteria Streptococcus pathogen or pyogenes from the throat and with tonsillitis. They incubated the bacteria and then tested each of the essential oils against it. The researchers found that 14 of the 18 essential oils had antibacterial activity against the Streptococcus bacteria. And of these, cinnamon oil, thyme oil, lemongrass oil, and marjoram oil, and wintry savory had the greatest antibiotic effect against tonsillitis bacteria. Again, cinnamon oil, thyme oil, lemongrass, marjoram, and winter savory. So, two other oils, clove and palmarosa lemongrass, were also up there. So, this is just new, important, and good quality science. Now, that's another business. I want people to start doing their own little home-based business to get ready for some transition. This is one of those things you can do as a transition from living in an urban and suburban environment in your backyard, on a rooftop garden, in your own little hydroponic shed. You can grow everything I just mentioned. Once you grow it, you can then dry it, or you can make oils, or you can sell it to a company that makes the oils. And for our classroom on the air today, just want to let you know that we're not getting good bacteria. To the contrary, we're mainly, if you're the average American, you're promoting a bad bacteria because the amount of sugar and fructose and meat and processed foods. Also, stress. Stress creates a high degree of cytokines, and that is pro-inflammatory. That destroys the mitochondria. So you want to start with good thoughts, good bacteria, and eating sauerkraut and fermented foods, miso. These are all good. Or supplementing. And the latest study shows that probiotics can restore your body's natural intestine-based protection against a host of non-intestinal diseases and shield you from the diseases of aging. And it's long been known that certain types of beneficial gut bacteria should be taken on a daily basis. Why? Because when you're eating the right bacteria It helps break down dietary residues like indigestible fibers. It synthesizes vitamins. It limits pathogenic colonization within the gut, meaning the bad bacteria that lead to infections are killed. And it plays a crucial role in the immune system, an estimation between 70-80% of which is located in and around your gut. So by looking at all the good things you can do, it's easy. Just make sure you're getting your probiotics each day, and that then colonizes more, and that can bring down your bad HDL cholesterol. It can turn off inflammation throughout your body. It can help reduce DNA damage that could trigger malignant cell development, respectively. It can improve your blood sugar level. So if you're pre-diabetic or diabetic, probiotics can help that. And it can help reverse putrefaction within the intestines, something that is, I would say, 98% of all Americans have. And it can suppress bacteria that convert pro-carcinogen molecules into carcinogens. It can bind to potential carcinogens, promoting their excretion. It can decrease enzymes implicated in the development of carcinogens. It can boost populations of immune cells that play a role in tumor inhibition. It can upregulate immune cytokines to battle the early stages of cancer. And it suppresses the inflammation responses to cancer or the infection threat fades. So for diabetes, for cancer, for heart disease, it's good. And the lethal implications, the link between our bad gut and increased disease is clear. This is not controversial. Thousands of studies exist on this. So every time you have good bacteria, you're disrupting bad bacteria. Bad bacteria are created by antibiotics. Probably the single worst cause today, because antibiotics destroy all bacteria, and then bad bacteria grow back. Then infant formulas. They commonly use infant formulas instead of breast milk, and that interferes with the history of transferring bacterial delivery through diversity from the mother to the baby. And also, the Western diet, high in animal proteins and fats and sugars, that's what's causing a lot of this bad bacteria. And then a lot of medical treatments also destroy good bacteria. So let's get the good bacteria in every day. I'm going to suggest on the low end, 1 billion. On the high end, 10 billion, 20 billion. There are some cases I even go higher. And finally, before we take our break, I'm always asked about people who have different conditions. And one of the most common in America is different forms, arrhythmias of the heart. There are three things I suggest. First and foremost, understand that there's no medicine that can prevent the heart from overreacting. Most people are not aware that my research, though I've never read it anywhere yet, but almost every time I ask someone who has any form of tachycardia, arrhythmias, AFib, they've all had surgery. When you've had surgery and you've had a general anesthetic, it's one of the most common causes of heart irregularities. They never tell you this. And then one day, you don't even know you have a problem until you have a heart attack. So what do? They give you a blood thinner. All right? A blood thinner can help prevent a stroke. But the blood thinners also destroy the B complex, including B6, folic acid, vitamin C, B12, and trimethylglycine, which prevent heart attacks. So here's the irony. When was the last time you saw an ad that says, take our medication, it'll prevent a stroke, like an aspirin will, but it's going to increase your risk of heart attacks because it's going to increase the amino acid homocysteine, which increases your heart attack risk. Here's the simple advice. Optimizing your omega-3 fatty acid levels. I'm suggesting 2,000 to 3,000 milligrams a day. Then, I'm suggesting that if you have that, what you're going to understand is heart arrhythmias are leading cause of sudden cardiac death, and normal heart rhythms had traditionally been treated with prescriptions. Well, there's a lot of evidence that the omega-3 fatty acids from fish oil or flax can prevent sudden cardiac death, which is likely mediated through the rhythm-stabilizing effect. Individuals with lower levels of the omega-3 intake are more likely to experience heart arrhythmias. So the more of that you're using within a reasonable amount, the safer your heart. And then understand that magnesium actually helps to stabilize rhythms. And then the third thing that is a definite, makes an enormous difference, would be an herb, hawthorn berry extract, generally anywhere between 300 to 500 milligrams, magnesium about 1,000 milligrams, or just below diarrhea. So with omega-3 fatty acids, now mind you, there are other things good for your heart, but for different reasons, L-carnitine and coenzyme Q10 and vitamin E, but that's not for a regular heartbeat. That's for strengthening the mitochondria, increasing adenosine triphosphate, so your heart actually has more energy. I'm talking about actually normalizing. I've been able to normalize people's rhythms with no medication. Just normalize them. Because hawthorn actually helps stabilize the rhythm and the beat of the heart. So this is something that people just don't know. In fact, unfortunately, their doctors don't even know. Not even cardiologists know. And they should. Because they could be saving lives. That's the latest on health and nutrition. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome, all of you. I'm Gary Nall. In a few moments, about 10 minutes now, we're going to speak with Dr. Bart Billings about psychiatric drugs and the psychiatric failure to treat military personnel. And that'll be an interesting discussion. But a few things before we get there, including I want to give you this from Bryce Covert from Think Progress, quote, "No, the poor aren't poor because they waste their money. As a percentage of their budgets, the poor spend more on the necessities and have less money left over for things like eating out and entertainment, according to the latest data on consumer spending from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The lowest 20% in income spend just over $22,000 a year, while the richest 20% has nearly $100,000 to spend eating out. That makes sense, given that they have more money overall. About $167,000 a year before taxes compared to under $10,000 for the poor. But the poorest also put more of that money towards necessities. Housing is the biggest difference, as the poor spend about a quarter of their tight budgets on either rent or a mortgage, while the rich spend 18%. The poor also spend double the share on utilities, about 10% versus 5% for the rich, and more on transportation. In all, the lowest income group in America spends more than 60% of its budget on basics, housing, utilities, transportation, home-cooked food, while the rich spend much less. The gulf also opens up when it comes to the finer things of life. The poor spend nearly double the share that the rich spend on food they take home to cook, while the rich spend way more eating out. The rich also spend more on entertainment and alcoholic beverages. So, here's the takeaway message. The next time you hear someone saying, well, think of what we give these people. You know, we're giving them food stamps or just a bunch of lazy bums. Are they? Well, then maybe you should be where I've been for the last 5 years, filming thousands of Americans who are poor. And they try to budget their money very wisely. And they're actually very prudent. But if we saw how prudent they were and how much they actually spend on food and take it home and eat at home, versus those who have money and don't think twice about where they spend their money, maybe we would have a different perception and wouldn't be as biased and thoughtless and insensitive and callous towards them. Double-dip doctors. This bothered me. This is from ProPublica, and it's from Charles Ornstein and Ryan Jones. Quote, pharmaceutical companies pay for the clinical trials that Dr. Golan conducts on antibiotics at Tufts Medical Center. They also pay him tens of thousands of dollars a year to give speeches and advice on behalf of their drugs. If Golan worked at some teaching hospitals, he would be barred or severely restricted from accepting both research funding and personal payments for promotional speaking or consulting from drug markets. These hospitals fear the money could influence clinical findings or at least create an appearance of a conflict of interest. Yet Tufts University and many other academic medical centers allow doctors to accept overlapping payments. And so they looked at 1,300 practitioners nationwide who make a lot of money. They received $90 million in research grants plus $13 million in speaking engagements, another $4 million in consulting. And these people work for the pharmaceutical industry. So here's my question to you. How objective do you think it's going to be if a doctor is paid $1 million a year to go to conferences in exotic locales around the world and spend an hour or two in the daytime giving a lecture on a class of drugs that that doctor has been paid to research? Do you think they're going to be honest if the drug doesn't work or if the drug is dangerous? And that's why we are using so many dangerous drugs with so much adverse effects, and all of medicine is just awash in conflict of interest. And yet, when it comes to vaccines, their safety, who do they always prayed up to say vaccines are safe and effective and anyone challenging them are just unfortunate, unscientific people? They never show you the millions, in some cases tens of millions of dollars, some of these individuals have made from the vaccine patents they own and the vaccine research their entire department is given, and the fact that they're paid everything, every nickel that they need to go anywhere in the world to talk about vaccines. Yet they never, when they're on one of these programs in the morning, say, oh, by the way, before I tell you that Gardasil is safe, I think I should also tell you that I made X millions of dollars for it, and I'm paid X million more for lectures. Then we're going to say, well, I'm not going to believe you. But they don't tell us that. And hence the public is given the idea that the people who are out there as experts are the ones, and yet they'll deny a mother who is the best expert on her child as saying that child couldn't have gotten sick because of the vaccine. It's not possible. Well, there are over 1 million mothers who say, yes, my child was developing normally to the vaccine, and now my child's either dead or brain damaged, and nobody wants to be responsible. So that's how, unfortunately, that's how corrupt the ethical basis of science has become in the United States. And that's unfortunate. In a moment, the school privatization and the charter school scam, corporate America's neo-feudal assault on education, and my own particular views in this, because I want to try something, and I'll share what I did. But just a couple program announcements. First up, I'm going to ask those of you who believe in standing up and standing forward against social injustice to join me. I'll be one of the keynote speakers at Stop Psych Assaults, Protect the American People and from the Psychiatric Abuses. This will be across from the Jacob Javits Convention Center on May 4th at noon. And we'll be talking about stop forced drugging, stop electroconvulsive therapy, the no restraints, no seclusions, no aversives, no child kidnapping, end denials to medical treatment, stop diagnosing our human experience as a pathology. So when you consider how many Americans have been abused, overtreated, overdiagnosed, including children, 10 million American children each day start their life with a end day with a type 2 narcotic in the same class as heroin and cocaine. And we didn't have anyone starting their day with this when I was growing up. But then again, medicine, pharmaceutical industry learned how to pathologize normal behavior. So I'm going to be protesting. I'll be standing out there and demonstrating against the American Psychiatric Association at their annual convention. Please put it on your calendar to join me. And in the past, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of you have joined. Not from the station. I don't expect that. That's not going to happen. But from my audience, yes, you have always come forward. Do you remember when 6,000 of you marched with us to Washington, D.C., and then stood in front of the White House to protest genetically engineered foods? Yep. And how thousands of us stood out in front of the governor's office the police had the largest demonstration against the governor's office ever. And then in front of Indian Point to protest at Indian Point, and over in the park, the Hudson Park, protesting there. We had Helen Caldicott that day. So we're always protesting somewhere on an important issue. This is an important issue. Put it on your calendar, please. May 4th, 34th Street and 11th Avenue, crossing the Javits Center, at noon, stop the assault on the American public by the psychiatric community. And I'll specifically be going through what I call the comic book of psychiatry, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual number 5. And I'll show you some of the new conditions that they consider brain chemical imbalances that there is no scientific reference research whatsoever to prove it is. So that's one demonstration. Then tomorrow evening, something upbeat, a Planet Heart. I was invited to be a keynote tomorrow night at their annual World Peace Earth Day celebration and benefit. There'll be good music, a sense of community from the Earth community people, and give a call. It's going to be tomorrow evening, 5 to 10:30, and there's going to be a World Peace panel. Then there's, at 5 o'clock, a Mother Earth panel at 7 o'clock. And somewhere in there I'm going to be, I don't know where, but I'll give you a phone number to call to join me tomorrow night. It'll be fun. And it's going to be at 230 West 29th Street, between 7th and 8th in Manhattan. So it's to celebrate a different perspective on world peace and the Earth. Call 212-222-5432. 212-222-5432. I'm donating my time, as I always do, to these causes because I believe in them. I believe that in life, it is who shows up that counts, not those who have 1,000 reasons and excuses for not. Just imagine if none of us showed up for anything that was relevant. Where would we be? Where would any movement be? But this will be a fun celebration and informative. And you'll meet a lot of other people associated with the peace movement and the Mother Earth movement. That's tomorrow night at from 5 to 10:30 at 230 West 29th Street. Call 212-222-5432 for more information. Also, this Friday, I'm going to go filming. And I won't be doing any more filming on this particular project. This ends at 7 years. I'm finally done. And but I'll be taking my film crew. If anybody would like to join us to see how I film and what we film, I'm going to be doing two stops. I'm going to Camden, New Jersey, the most dangerous and poor city in the United States. And on the way, I'm also down or on the way back, I'm going to stop off at a tent city in the middle of the woods in New Jersey to show you a group of people from all walks of life who are now homeless. And I'm filming them. Now, I filmed them 2 years ago. I want to find out what happened in the 2 years since and what's changed in their lives. And we're going to see what's happening in Camden. I'll go over to the Sacred Heart Church. I'll film there. I'm going to film any new development they have that shows promise and hope. And then I'm going to go into some of their homes. I want to show you what it's like to be poor in Camden. And we haven't planned any of this stuff. As you'll see, I'm just going to go up and knock on doors and ask, can I come in and film them? Tell their story to the world. And trust me, when I say I'm going to show the story of the world, a lot of people watch. Just go up and Google Seeds of Death, our latest one on GMOs. This morning I Googled it and there were about 105 million searches. And under the specific of the film, there was over 25 million. So the word's getting out. And this will get out too. This will be officially released at the end of the summer. It'll take us that long to finish it. So if you want to join me this Friday, I'm going to leave with my crew at 8 o'clock. You can call today, 646-926-5422, 646-926-5422. And if you have a car, good, because I don't think we're going to have room unless you want to be strapped on to the... We'll put a Mitt Romney sticker on you. It'll be an interesting day. And you'll see how people live that nobody wants to be near. And that's unfortunate. Because they're just as sacred and just as precious as anyone else. Their circumstances are different. I'm only going to give you a bit of this, and then I'll come back to my guest in a second. From Vicky Pelez, human rights organizations, as well as political and social ones, are condemning what they're calling a new form of inhumane exploitation in the United States, where they say a prison population of up to 2 million, mostly black and Hispanic, are working for various industries for pittance. For the tycoons who have invested in the prison industry, it has been like finding a pot of gold. They don't have to worry about strikes or paying unemployment insurance, vacations, or comp time. All of their workers are full-time and never arrive late or are absent because of family problems. Moreover, if they don't like the pay of 25 cents an hour and refuse to work, they are locked up in isolation, solitary confinement. There are approximately 2 million inmates in state and federal prison, private prisons throughout the country. According to California Prison Focus, quote, no other society in human history has imprisoned so many of its own citizens. The figures show that the United States has locked up more people than any other country, a half a million more than China, which has a population 5 times greater than the United States. Statistics reveal that the United States holds 25% of the world's prison population, but only 5% of the world's people. From less than 300,000 inmates in 1972, the jail population grew to 2 million by the year 2000. In 1990, it was 1 million. 10 years ago, there were only 5 private prisons in the country with a population of 2,000 inmates. Now there are 100 with 62,000 inmates, and it's expected to keep growing for this decade. It'll hit 360,000. What has happened over the last 10 years? Why are there so many prisoners? Quote, the private contracting of prisoners for work fosters incentives to lock people up. Prisons depend upon this income. Corporate stockholders who make money off prisoners' work lobby for longer sentences in order to expand their workforce. The system feeds itself, end quote. So said Progressive Labor Party a progressive labor party, which accuses the prison industry of being an imitation of Nazi Germany with respect to forced slave labor and concentration camps. The prison industry complex is one of the fastest growing industries in the United States, and its investors are on Wall Street. Quote, this multi-million-dollar industry has its own trade exhibitions, conventions, websites, and mail-order internet catalogs. It also has direct advertising campaigns. Architectural companies, construction companies, investment houses on Wall Street, plumbing supply companies, food supply companies, armed security, and padded cells in a large variety of colors. According to the Left Business Observer, the federal prison industry provides 100% of all military helmets, ammunition belts, bulletproof vests, IT tags, shirts, pants, tents, bags, canteens. Along with war supplies, prison workers supply 98% of the entire market for equipment assembly services, 93% of paints and paint brushes, 92% of stove assemblies, 46% of body armor, 36% of home appliances, 30% of headphones, microphones, and speakers, and 21% of office furniture. Airplane parts, medical supplies, and much more. Prisoners are even raising seeing-eye dogs for blind people. Crime goes up, jail population goes up. Crime goes down, jail population goes up. According to reports by human rights organizations, these are the factors that increase the potential of those who invest in the prison industrial complex. Jailing persons convicted of nonviolent crimes and long prison sentences for possession of microscopic quantities of illegal drugs, federal law stipulates 5 years imprisonment without possibility of parole for possession of 5 grams of crack and 3.5 ounces of heroin, and 10 years for possession of less than 2 ounces of rock, cocaine, or crack. A sentence of 5 years for cocaine powder requires possession of 500 grams. In Texas, a person may be sentenced up to 2 years imprisonment for just 4 ounces of marijuana. In New York, the 1973 Nelson Rockefeller anti-drug law provides for a mandatory prison sentence for 15 years to life for possession of 4 ounces of an illegal drug. So you spend the rest of your life in prison for 4 ounces of marijuana? I guess that makes sense in New York, where they stop and search 500,000 blacks and Latinos each year. But did I miss something? Have they been stopping and searching any wealthy people, white people, famous people? How about all the models and actors and actresses before and after they're walking the red carpet? Do they ever stop and search? Because most of them are going to be high. No, they don't. How about the people coming out of the five-star restaurants? Never. How about Broadway shows? No. Coming out of Wall Street offices? No. Madison Avenue offices? No. How about on Park Avenue? How about stopping everyone coming out of the Koch brothers' apartment building? Start and search and search. No, not at all. So it's really just about racism, institutionalized, yes, and profit. Get them in prison, and someone's going to make a lot of money. The passage in 13 states of three strikes law, life in prison after being convicted of three felonies, made it necessary to build 20 new federal prisons. One of the most disturbing cases resulted from this measure was that of a prisoner who was stealing a car and two bicycles received 3 25-year sentences. So that's how it works, and that's why we have it, and that's wrong. But I just want you to know that the next time someone talks about law and order, why is it that all of the law supports those who are wealthy enough to break the law with impunity, like sending us to wars we should never have been in and lying to us, causing massive human suffering, and clearly violating the Geneva Convention. But for violating the Geneva Convention and causing the death of over 1 million Iraqis, nothing happens. No one goes to jail. But having 4 ounces of marijuana in New York, you can be sent away for a long time to life. Is there something wrong with this? There is. And that's the comment. Now let's go over to Carlsbad, California, say hello to my guest, Dr. Bart Billings, retired Army colonel, former military psychologist and founder and director of both the military-wide Human Assistance Rapid Response Team program to deal with combat stress and the International Military and Civilian Combat Stress Conference. And it's nice to have you with us, sir.
Good morning.
I'd like you to address a critical contradiction that exists in not only the military, but among civilian crime investigators between people who commit suicide or homicide while on psychiatric medication and the belief that there must be a motive to be uncovered. Now, you've written extensively on the latest Fort Hood killing and the evidence that the shooter, Ivan Lopez, was on multiple psychiatric drugs, and yet the military investigators are unable to determine a motive for his shooting spree. So using the foot of Fort Hood as an example, explain this dichotomy that modern psychiatry refuses to acknowledge, that these drugs distort the brain dramatically and can lead to murderous acts that do not necessarily demand a deeper motive.
Well, this has been going on for years. One of the things I want to point out before we really get into that, and I realized this, I was on another radio show earlier this week, and I was talking about the military's use of private companies' addictive substances. It goes back generations and generations. I recall when I got drafted during Vietnam in the 60s, my K-rations had a four-pack of cigarettes in them. And again, to become addicted as a young soldier who's very impressionistic, and the common practice of trading cigarettes and using cigarettes and becoming addicted to nicotine, and when leaving the military, a lot of these people were smokers. Same thing happened with alcohol. You can get alcohol pretty much for nothing in the military. It's very inexpensive at the time. And soldiers, when they did something well, they were rewarded with alcohol. The military finally realized that these substances are not healthy, are not appropriate, and more or less moved away from their use. And now we have psychiatric medications, which were advocated by the chief psychiatrist and in them the different military organizations, the Army, the Navy, Marines, etc., as early as 94. And I was working with some of these people at the time when they were advocating it. And actually, prior to the Persian Gulf, military personnel were not allowed to be deployed if they're on any type of psychiatric medication. Well, that all changed, and it changed because psychiatry in the 70s was basically going out of business. I was at a meeting of all the psychiatrists and psychologists in the Army in San Diego in the 70s when the chief Army psychiatrist made a statement that unless psychiatry can come up with something different, they're going to go out of business because the psychologists and social workers and marriage therapists and counselors were providing talk therapy, cognitive therapy, much more effectively and less expensive than the old traditional psychoanalysis. So the pharmaceutical companies at the time came to psychiatry's rescue and said, okay, let's focus on something that you can do that nobody else can do, and you can prescribe psychiatric medications. So you come up with a label, and we'll come up with a medication, and we will save your profession. And basically, that's what happened. I've been to different places. I was in the California, the Governor's Advisory Committee, the Penn State Hospital. I've seen that there were 97% of the patients were on psychiatric medications in the hospital, and when they were discharged, 97% of the patients were discharged on psychiatric meds. The director of that hospital was a pharmacist. It wasn't a mental health person. In the military, I've talked with, over the years, I spent 34 years in the military, active and reserve, and at the International Combat Stress Conference, which we're going to have this May, it's the 21st year, it's the longest running conference in the world on combat stress. We have people every year that come from active duty, they're on active duty, they come to learn, and they share the information about the tremendous use of psychiatric medications in the military. I was told by some social workers and medics that 90% of our soldiers on the battlefield were taking one form or another of psychiatric medications. They were getting antipsychotics to sleep instead of their food supplies. The first supplies that showed up would be these medications. So in terms of the Veterans Administration, I speak with the psychiatrist there, and it's not unusual for them to tell me that they medicate 98% of their people. So it's becoming, you know, it's very lucrative when the field of psychiatry and the pharmaceutical companies generate about $333 billion a year in prescribing these medications. So it's a big problem. More and more people are becoming aware of it. And in February 24, 2010, I actually, prior to that, convinced Congress to hold hearings to examine the relationship between psychiatric medication and suicide. And they did hold the hearings. And they didn't really follow through as well as they should have with the hearings. But some things are happening. The media has been publishing, you know, from Time Magazine to, you know, the New York Times and various media organizations throughout the country. They've been occasionally producing news releases and stories in the newspaper and radio, some television, talking about this, but nothing has happened dramatically. It's been a slow process. And let me finish with this. One of the successes, well, minimal successes, but it's a success nonetheless, is that April 10, 2012, the Army Medical Command Policy for treating post-traumatic stress disorder was changed. Dr. Jonathan Woodson, he's a vascular surgeon, Assistant Secretary of Defense, suggested the increase of integrative treatment and dropped certain psychiatric medications to lower levels of use.
So, well, that's good.
So gradually, things are happening, but it's kind of like, you know, the reason I use cigarettes in the military and you know, when I was in basic training in 68, it was a gradual process before people realized that cigarettes cause cancer. I remember...
Dr. Billings, let me just interject, because a lot of our stations are going to have to leave us now. We've reached the end of their program, but we're going to be continuing on with the Progressive Radio Network. For all of you who cannot stay longer, we thank you very much for listening. We'll be back tomorrow, but we're going to continue now with Dr. Bart Billings. There's several issues I still want to go into. Dr. Billings, before you go to your final statement there, I can hear your frustration, and I appreciate it because you're part of this culture. At the same time, we have over 23 current or former service personnel committing suicide each day. That means more American soldiers have taken their own lives than were killed in combat in Iraq or Afghanistan. So I don't believe that at this point we have years or decades or dozens of committees to go through, knowing the pushback on the other side is the military at the top does not move quickly. It almost never moves in the right direction. And asking for more time. And each time you say more time, you can just look at another day and how many more people have to die. So take us through the usual process a soldier undergoes when he suffers from combat stress and post-traumatic stress disorder and depression and any mental problem and visits the military psychologist or psychiatrist. What is the standard protocol of clinical assessment of this condition and treatment? And then please provide your critique for why this protocol is negligent and furthering the problems soldiers face in their lives. And aside from prescribing drugs that you mentioned earlier, which now have increased 700% over recent years, is there any other type of talk therapy that you mentioned, cognitive therapy or counseling, to help these men and women?
I'll answer the last question first. The Army has for years, and actually I was responsible for overseeing a combat stress company, that sole job is to go into combat and provide the counseling and the support for soldiers who are experiencing combat stress. You know, in World War II, it was called battle fatigue, and we lost regiments of people to battle fatigue where they cannot operate due to the mental stress of combat. Back then in World War II, a lot of them got sent to the rear. There was a lot of talk therapy going on. And a good example was Spielberg's movie on the Pacific, which showed a Marine who got sent back to an island where it was there was no enemy. And it showed him talking with the psychiatrist out in the lawn about his problem, and then he went back into combat. It didn't show him being medicated, and that's pretty much what happened in the past. But because we weren't prepared, there was no readiness protocol in place for the Persian Gulf people's readiness for deployment, especially Reserve and National Guard. A lot of people came back with significant problems, and they had significant problems when they were in combat, too. And these problems were not handled by combat stress companies. The Marines didn't even know that the Army had a combat stress company and went out in the battlefield to support our troops until CBIRF didn't know it. That's the Marines Chemical Biological Group. They were at a combat stress conference that we did, and I had a scenario where they had to work with our people, and they said, oh, well, we didn't know the Army had this. So, you know, it hasn't been fully implemented, the combat stress program, combat stress companies that do the counseling and the supportive stuff. What's been happening on the battlefield is because of the excuse is that we don't have enough people to support and do the counseling, so we have to medicate. Well, that's an excuse. That's psychiatry's excuse. And remember, psychiatry runs mental health in the military as well as the civilian community. They oversee social workers, psychologists, et cetera, and they make decisions on what treatments are going to be provided. If their sole profession depends on them providing psychiatric meds, you can count on this happening. I had a social worker in one of our combat stress conferences who said that in Afghanistan, the psychiatrist in charge of the mental health unit that she was with came up to her and said, why are they wasting my time sending social workers? You cannot prescribe medication. I don't really need you here. I need somebody that can prescribe medications. And that same social worker told me a story about when she was in Iraq, how the psychiatrist was ordering so many psychiatric meds from the pharmacy that the pharmacist refused to fill any more subscriptions or prescriptions. And he went into the pharmacy, took these medications, and put them in plastic bags, put them in her footlocker, and distributed them to the troops, just handed them out. This is not as uncommon as it seems. So these are the problems. So somebody has a problem, which I want to explain. Combat stress, post-traumatic stress, is not a disorder to start with. Post-traumatic stress, and I've been saying this since the 70s, is a normal reaction for an individual with a normal brain going into an abnormal situation. It's a normal reaction to being in that situation. Just as if in the civilian world, I mean, when I was 18, I was the first to arrive at an accident where two people were killed, and I had thoughts about that afterwards. That was a degree of post-traumatic stress. That's normal. It's a normal reaction to being in an abnormal environment. When these people come back from combat, they still have their normal brain if they haven't been medicated in combat, and they have to normalize themselves, and they can learn how to deal with the nightmares. They can learn how to deal with the hypervigilance, et cetera, through integrative wellness programs, through integrative treatment.
Here's what I'd like to do, Dr. Billings. This is going to require a full hour, uninterrupted. And we do a full hour with a very large audience called Progressive Commentary Hour on Monday nights from 7 to 8. I'm going to ask Richard Gale to call you and invite you back to be the guest for a full hour, uninterrupted, so you have all the time you need to explain this in detail. All right?
Sure.
Both the problem and the correct treatment so we can help save lives. That's what you want. That's what we want. So I appreciate you giving us, in effect, an opening, raising a curtain on an issue we did not know exists to the degree that it does, and then what the solutions are. So Dr. Bart Billings will be back with us for a full hour coming up on the Progressive Commentary Hour. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you, Dr. Billings, and thank all of you for listening. Now let's go over and say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today we're talking about New York schools being the most segregated in the nation. Truck drivers for the U.S. Postal Service are organizing against privatization. And President Obama and Reverend Sharpton would like a whole bunch of volunteers to do work that they should be paid for.
Volunteers for Sharpton?
Yes, they they're organizing a...
I'm sure he does.
Yeah, so it's...
We'll look forward to that. Gee whiz.
Thank you.
What a character, right?
I tell you.
Back in a moment.